I'm Doug Fabrizio. In Morgan Neville's new documentary about Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers, the question comes up, why did his television show work as well as it did? It was, of course, immensely popular, but why? As one of the producers of the show mentions in the film, if you take all the elements of what make good television and then just do the exact opposite, you would have Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. But here's why it really worked, according to the film. Love. Fred Rogers believed love was at the root of everything. In fact, Neville says Rogers lived by a code of radical kindness. Today in the program, we're talking with Morgan Neville about his film premiering at the Sundance Film Festival, Won't You Be My Neighbor? Join us after the news.
Each morning as you drive the kids to school, KUER's Radio West team is preparing a new conversation that explores the way the world works. They connect with scholars, authors, and interesting people, and delve into the questions that bring context and understanding, so that when 9 o'clock rolls around, you can spend an hour expanding your mind and heart. Trusted voices, powered by you. Support Radio West today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. As Morgan Neville shows in his new documentary, when Fred Rogers sang, "Won't You Be My Neighbor," as he did on every single show for more than 31 seasons on public television, he thought of it as an invitation. As Rogers put it, an invitation for somebody to be close to you. Neville's film is showing in the documentary premieres category at the Sundance Film Festival, and in it, he explores what Rogers meant by neighborhood. It was an expansive, inclusive idea as much as a place he had in mind. As the biographer Max King says in the film, Rogers thought a neighborhood was a place where you felt safe, where people would offer you understanding. In some ways, Neville says it was a lesson about citizenship, how we learn to look after one another. But the film also points out Rogers didn't think of a neighborhood as a fantasy place where people always lived happily ever after. He knew there would be conflict. And he understood deeply that while children wanted to feel safe, they also deserved to be told the truth. It's why Fred Rogers talked to them about war and death and divorce. The film conveys this sense of mutual respect that he cultivated. Rogers trusted kids, and they trusted him back. And that's why for 3 decades, millions took up that weekly invitation, "Won't You Be My Neighbor?" That's the name of Morgan Neville's film, and tonight we're at the Utah Olympic Park in Park City talking with him about it. Morgan Neville directs the film, of course. He's been making films about culture and music for more than 20 years. He won the Academy Award in 2014 for Best Documentary with 20 Feet from Stardom. His film Best of Enemies was also shortlisted for an Oscar. Welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I guess I wanted to begin... The thing that kept coming up to me over and over again, at least at first, and I'm not sure it actually wore off, was just the delight that I remembered as a kid from Fred Rogers. And I wondered, how much do you think the film is informed by that perception that you got when you were a kid, do you think?
I think it wasn't something I initially set out to make the film about, but as I started to make the film, what I realized is there was a part of Fred Rogers that occupied part of my memory and myself that was subconscious. Hmm. You know, really, his show was, the main viewership was kind of 2 to 7-year-olds. So a large part of what you remember about Fred Rogers is in your prehistory.
Right.
You know, it's something that as you go back and visit this, little bits come back. But it's part of what became really exciting about him is he... I mean, you can't think of anybody else other than, you know, Big Bird, who speaks to your inner child very literally, you know, who's, you know, speaking to you not before you've kind of adapted any adult labels or biases or anything. He's kind of speaking to you as an unformed person.
Yeah.
And then there's something about going back and revisiting him that takes you back to that inner core of who was I, where did I start,
yeah.
And what are the first principles of what we really want to be as a human.
Did that, do you think, give you a special, that sense, that relationship? Did that make you feel a special responsibility to deal with this life in a special way? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I have felt a huge responsibility. I mean, for starters, you know, he did everything in Pittsburgh. He was from Latrobe, just down the road. But he stayed in Pittsburgh. He was offered all kinds of things to leave Pittsburgh, but he felt that it was important for him to stay where his roots were. And if anybody knows Pittsburgh, he is, you know, it's like, you know, the Steelers and Fred Rogers are the two things people in Pittsburgh care about.
Right
where the rivers meet in the middle of downtown, there's a statue of Fred Rogers.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you the number of times when I was in a car, an Uber in Pittsburgh making this film, and I would mention what I was working on, and they'd turn around and say, "Don't screw this up." So I definitely felt the responsibility.
How did the idea come to you?
So it came to me in the most unexpected way. That I'd made a film called The Music of Strangers with Yo-Yo Ma. And when I was starting that film, one day at lunch, I was having lunch with Yo-Yo, and I, out of the blue, said, "Yo-Yo, how did you figure out how to be a famous person?" And he said, "Oh, Mr. Rogers taught me."
Wow.
And I kind of laughed, and he said, "No, I'm not kidding. You know, I went on a show when I was young. I went on many times, and we became good friends. But he realized that what I was going through when I was young, that I was struggling with this notoriety, and he really went out of his way to teach me about the other F word, fame. And he showed me how I could use my notoriety as a, you know, as a force for positive change and good." And that kind of blew my mind when he told me that. And I just filed it away and said, I'm going to come back to this at some point.
Yeah.
And what that led me to, you know, was a series of breadcrumbs that made me start to kind of reevaluate who I thought Fred Rogers was and who he could be. And I think it kind of culminated in like a all-night YouTube deep dive where I started looking into what Fred was doing and just, I mean, really more than anything, it was like, this is a voice I want to hear.
Yeah.
It's like, here's an adult. Like, where are the grown-ups anymore? Like, here's an adult who is respectful, who doesn't speak down to people, who doesn't sugarcoat, who is not a Pollyanna. He's a realist, you know. And there were so many things about him that I just felt, I want this. And at the time, I called Yo-Yo's son, Nicholas Ma, who I became very good friends with making the film, and he's a filmmaker, and he became very close with the Rogers family. And I called him up and said, is this a crazy idea to make a film about Fred Rogers? And he said, "I love that idea." And he's my producer on the film.
Yeah.
So we set off on this journey to make this film, but in a completely unexpected way.
So one of those, I'm imagining, one of those deep dives into YouTube brought you to this video. And it's a moment that appears in the film, mm-hmm. and I want to talk a little bit about it. This is from 1969, if I have that date right.
Yeah.
And public television is under attack. And there is this imperious, kind of grumpy senator named John Pastore, a Democrat from Rhode Island. He's in charge, and it's a congressional hearing about public television. Take it from there and set this up, because
sure.
It's such a great moment in the film.
Well, it's this incredible moment. You know, Johnson signs the Public Broadcasting Act in 1967. They launch PBS in 68. Nixon gets elected, and he said, "What are we doing paying for public broadcasting? Let's cut it." And this is really kind of, these are 3 days of testimony in the Senate to decide whether or not the government is going to continue with this idea called public broadcasting. And after 3 days of people giving testimony of all sorts, they bring in this young TV host, children's TV host, who had only been on air for 1 year at that point. He'd been on regional TV, but only on national TV for 1 year. And it's like a masterclass in how to turn somebody around. It's absolutely incredible. And somebody told me they actually showed this clip in in business school to teach you how to win people over. It's, you know, absolutely incredible. And he did it without notes, impromptu. He was going to read his testimony. And
it comes through in the film. And this moment is from the testimony. But Pastore is completely impatient with everybody else reading these statements. He's through with it. And then Fred Rogers comes up, and he seems a little nervous, but it's really a remarkable moment. Let's play this moment.
I end the program by saying, you've made this day a special day by just your being you. There's no person in the whole world like you, and I like you just the way you are. And I feel that if we in public television can only make it clear that feelings are mentionable and manageable, we will have done a great service.
And we should say, he melted the heart of that crusty old senator.
He did. I mean, this is something that does, it's a real, like, Mr. Rogers goes to Washington moment, because at the end of the testimony, John Pastore says, it looks like you just got your $20 million.
Yeah.
And that was it. It was over. Like, there was nothing else to talk about. You know, he just melted him, literally.
When you first saw that, though,
yeah,
what were you thinking? Because one thing you've talked about is when you saw that, you felt like this was the thing we need to hear?
Yeah. I mean, it's somebody who, again, like, I was used to seeing him as a kid, but when you start to see how he would speak to adults, it's so powerful because he is fearless when it comes to wielding something adults don't wield, which is emotion. I mean, he is just speaking directly to who they are, and he doesn't let them off the hook. The other piece of film that really made me realize there was a movie here is he did a number of specials after national tragedies and after Bobby Kennedy's assassination in 1968, in June of 68, he decided that week, spontaneously, the next day, that America, you know, that the Kennedy funeral was going to be on Saturday, and that Friday night he needed to speak to the parents because kids were going to be home and they were going to see this and they're trying to process what this means. And he did a half-hour program, only aired one time in 1968, speaking to adults and explaining how they should help their children process this. And, you know, I it's absolutely, David Bianculli, the TV critic, said he thinks it's the greatest moment in the history of television. You know, it's just kind of the courage that Fred had. I mean, that's the thing. Everybody thinks of Fred as such a kind of milquetoast guy and, like, you know, is he for real? But the guy had an iron will. I mean, he was amazing. And that's what I responded to.
Yeah. Here's that moment.
I felt that I had to speak to the families of our country about grief. So many families and children were taking these catastrophes personally. Among many other things, my main point in mounting such a program was to present a plea for families to include their children in their own ways of coping with grief. A plea not to leave the children isolated and at the mercy of their own fantasies of loss and destruction.
That's Fred Rogers, of course, from Morgan Neville's latest documentary. It's called Won't You Be My Neighbor? It's part of this year's Sundance Film Festival. There are still two chances to see it. You can see it Friday afternoon in Park City, Saturday evening in Salt Lake City. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, a conversation with the filmmaker Morgan Neville. We were talking about his documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor? It's about the life and ministry of Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers. We spoke with Neville last week at the Utah Olympic Park in Park City. What did he think of kids? I mean, at its core, at its base.
Well, I mean, what's amazing about Fred is he thought about kids as people, not as kids. And we talk about it in the film. I mean, he had a graduate degree in child development. And what I didn't realize is he had actually stumbled across one of the most progressive children's development scenes in America. So at the University of Pittsburgh, at the Arsenal Family Center, was this incredible group of people working in childhood development in the early 60s in Pittsburgh. And it was Eric Erickson and Benjamin Spock and Margaret McFarlane, and they were there in Pittsburgh, and Fred worked with them and learned from them. And so a lot of what we've come to think about in terms of childhood development was really happening, and this is 1961, 2, 3, in Pittsburgh. So he was really cutting edge in how he thought about a lot of this stuff. And a large part of it is children, if you condescend to them, they will, you know, respond in kind. You have to speak to them as humans. They have a really good detector of whether or not you're speaking the truth. Yeah. So he decided to forge this relationship with children. And it's something else that he did that nobody else did, is on his show, he always spoke directly to camera, and he never, ever said, "Hey, kids." It was always, "How are you? What's happening today?" And he had a one-on-one relationship with everybody on that other side of that camera. And I think that's part of why I think those of us who grew up with him feel the way we do, is we all feel like we had a very direct one-on-one relationship with him. And he had come along at the perfect time where television was this new medium, and he realized there was a generation of children who were going to be raised by this new medium and for whom they needed a kind of a moral compass and a parental figure on television, and that's who he was. He filled this role, and television became exactly what he expected it would be. And it was just the perfect, you know, matching of all of these things. And he saw it from the moment he first saw television. He realized that this was going to be my life's calling.
There's this moment that he tells. It's a great story in the film where he talks about going to a nursery school and meeting these children and talking to a little boy by the name of Thatcher. Mm-hmm. And this little boy says to Mr. Rogers, and he's telling the story in the film, all he said was that my doggy's ear came off in the automatic washer. And then Rogers, as he's telling, it's a great story, he says, and then there was complete silence. It was as if Rogers says, this moment was a test. Would you talk about that moment?
Sure. I mean, it's the moment where Fred becomes Fred. You know, it's where he's there doing this work in, you know, preschool settings and with kids, and he's trying to figure out what he's doing. It's before the show's launched. And he thinks about how to answer this question, and he says to Thatcher, well, that happens sometimes, doesn't it, to our toys in the wash? Their ears will come off, or their legs will come off, or their arms might come off. But that never happens to us. When we're in the bathtub, our arms don't come off, and our ears don't come off, and our legs don't come off, and their eyes are getting bigger, and the kids are... And he said suddenly the kids erupted, and they started asking him 1,000 questions. It was like, you can speak to us. You get us. And like, you're our window into what this world is about. And that's something I think Fred really took to heart. He realized the door had opened and there was no going back.
There's this question that comes up early on, and I kept thinking about it. It comes up in the end, too, and we'll get back to it. But it was offered by Jean-Li Lee of the Fred Rogers Center in one of the interviews that you did. And he talks about how there's a big question right now as to whether or not Rogers' attempt to influence America succeeded. Talk a little bit about that as a question about whether or not that, what he left us with, I guess, if it worked.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge question. I mean, it's a question that, you know, I would like to think, you know, with the film that his work's not done. You know, I think if we're really getting down to kind of when I had to distill everything about Fred down into one bumper sticker, it was the idea of radical kindness. It was this idea that I'm going to show extreme empathy, extreme understanding. And it's something, I think the central tension in the film is not within Fred, but it's between Fred and the outside world, who is constantly drifting further and further away from this kind of vision he had for it. And I think we're still drifting. So, I mean, really part of why I wanted to make the film was to have a discussion about these things, you know, to have a discussion about moral leadership and kindness and empathy. And the other thing we haven't talked about is he was a Presbyterian minister.
Yeah.
So people don't even really know that. And essentially what he was doing was a secular ministry. Not even that secular. He just wouldn't say the words Jesus and God. But if you really think about, won't you be my neighbor, it's love thy neighbor. I mean, it's not a stretch to think about it. So to him, I think also to kind of put it, and I've tried to avoid this, of thinking, oh, you know, are you trying to label that Fred was a liberal or he was this or that? And I think he would disagree with it and say, no, I'm a Christian. You know, these aren't liberal or conservative values. These are just Christian values. I think that was always his center. And I think that's a really interesting kind of conversation to have right now about what Christian values are.
Here's another moment from the film. This is Margie Whitmer, a producer with Fred Rogers for years, talking about, you'll also hear Fred here, talking about why his show worked.
We had a director that once said to me, you take all of the elements that make good television and do the exact opposite. You have Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Low production values, simple set, unlikely star. Yet, it worked. Because he was saying something really important.
Love is at the root of everything. All learning, all parenting, all relationships. Love or the lack of it. And what we see and hear on the screen is part of who we become.
He was going to go into the seminary.
Mm-hmm.
I guess become a minister, I suppose. But then, as he tells in this moment, he saw television. Or he saw, quote-unquote, children's television. And that seemed to kind of change everything. Here's another moment from the film.
But I went home my senior year for a vacation in La Trobe, and I saw this new thing called television. And I saw people throwing pies in each other's faces. And I thought, this could be a wonderful tool for education. Why is it being used this way? And so I said to my parents, you know, I don't think I'll go to seminary right away. I think maybe I'll go into television.
Yeah, and his dad said, but you've never seen it.
Do you have any idea what kind of a quote-unquote minister he might have been? As you said, he didn't talk a lot, at least in public, about the particulars of faith.
No, I mean, one of his friends, a fellow minister who had gone to seminary with him, said that when Fred, as part of his ministerial studies, had to go address congregations and do that kind of work, that he wouldn't let anybody he knew go, but that the word got around, that he was exceptionally gifted at speaking to crowds in that way. But he was always kind of embarrassed about it. And But another minister friend of his who we interview in the film said he thought Fred was the best preacher he'd ever met. You know, somebody who could speak not just to one's mind, but really get directly into their heart and directly into their soul. I mean, he just had this incredible ability to kind of filter out everything that wasn't important and just speak in such nakedly emotional and truthful terms that there was no getting away from it. You just succumbed to it as a congregant or as a kid.
I wanted to ask you about what you wanted to do with the film in this sense. He almost seems too good to be true.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if that worried you.
It did. I mean, there are stories in there
yeah.
that I think that undercut it. And I think That was something that was very important to me in the beginning, is this is not a hagiography.
Yeah.
And the thing about Fred, and this is something when I went to first talk about making this film down to Pittsburgh and I met with Mrs. Rogers, the thing she said to me that gave me great faith in their trust was, she said, Fred was not a saint and you shouldn't make him out to be one. And what's important about that is if you think of Fred as a saint, it kind of lets the rest of us off the hook to actually have to do any hard work to be moral actors in this world. We're like, well, he was unique. He was
different, special. Yeah.
But when you see the amount of struggle he put up with and the difficult decisions that he didn't always make the right decision that we talk about in the film, I think those were hugely important. That he was not a saint. He was very much a human dealing with these massive moral quandaries. And that was 100% essential to me.
When did he start using puppets? Where did that come from?
Well, he was always into puppets. Even as a boy, he had dummies and everything else. But the story goes that he had an incredibly kind of unusual trajectory as a young man. So he went to Dartmouth, and then he didn't like it. He transferred to Rollins College. He became a composition major, and he met his wife there, Mrs. Rogers, Joanne, who's in the film, who's fantastic.
She is.
And he decided then on the spring break when he sees television that I'm going to go into TV, and his dad knew somebody who knew somebody at this new TV network, NBC, and he went to work in Rockefeller Center. And he worked on the Kate Smith Show and Your Show of Shows, and he was there in the thick of it. And particularly because he understood composition, he worked with Leonard Bernstein and a lot of people who were doing kind of classical broadcasts on NBC at the time, if you can imagine such a thing. And at that point, somebody said, well, they're going to start something called educational television, and the first station in the country is in Pittsburgh, your hometown. And he said, well, that's what I'm doing. So he goes back, and he was, I think, the second employee at this new thing called educational television. This is 1953. And literally it was, you know, we have to fill up 10 hours a day, so you're doing everything. And they had an hour and a half live TV show for kids every day that he did with a local woman named Josie Carey. And one day, you know, just to fill up time, they would get films from the local library and show them. But they were in terrible shape, so they would break. And so they'd have to just vamp from live TV. And somebody had given Fred a tiger puppet as a present. And he put it through a sheet and started doing Daniel Tiger with zero preparation. Yeah, so that's where Daniel Tiger came from. It was literally a gift and a spontaneous stalling for time on live television. But there was something about that, too, that there was no filter. Again, it was like Daniel Tiger, for those of you who know Daniel Tiger, or your kids or your grandkids know Daniel Tiger.
What kind of a question is that? Everyone knows who Daniel Tiger is.
You know, Daniel Tiger is, it's Fred,
you
know, in so many ways. It is Fred.
Well, that comes across that... It was almost like his alter ego. They had this, somebody puts it in the film, a symbiotic relationship.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because I think over time, Fred came to have different symbiotic relationships with different members of the neighborhood. So people don't realize this, but of the, you know, 12 puppets of the neighborhood, you know, Fred did 10 of them. You know, Fred was King Friday. He was Lady Elaine Fairchild. He was Henrietta. You know, all of them, X the Owl. So his kids told me, for instance, that, you know, Lady Elaine Fairchild, who's the kind of unruly lady
grumpy.
Of the neighborhood, grumpy, that when Fred wanted to say something around the family dinner table in front of his children that was a little off-brand or angry, he would use Lady Elaine Fairchild's voice. And when he wanted to be stern, he would use King Friday's voice. Like, he couldn't do it in his own voice. This was literally how he was channeling parts of his personality. But Daniel was the central part. That was his own child. That was his own inner child, his own insecurities, his own wants and worries about being love and wanting others to love themselves.
It's hard to, it seems as if on some level, and maybe it wasn't physical, I didn't get that sense, and it's not conveyed in the film, but something happened in his childhood that didn't necessarily traumatize him, but he was full of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. He had fear. He didn't feel like he could express who he was. How do you understand his childhood after?
Well, I mean, there were a couple different things. We don't, you know, it gets so elaborate. But so one thing is his family was one of the richest families in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, where he grew up. You know, so it was Rolling Rock Beer, Arnold Palmer, and Fred Rogers, the three most famous sons of Latrobe. And he actually took golf lessons from Arnold Palmer's father.
Wow.
But because he grew up in this kind of mansion in town, right at the time of the Lindbergh kidnapping, there was so much paranoia about wealthy people's children being kidnapped that his parents really kind of locked him away for a couple of years. And on top of that, he was overweight as a child.
Yeah.
And he became the exact opposite as an adult. But his nickname in school was Fat Freddy. And I think it was a combination of the isolation, being an only child until his parents adopted a sister when he was 12. But essentially, throughout his childhood, he was an only child, he was overweight, and he was a latchkey kid for many of those years. And I think all of that meant that he had to keep his own company. And puppets were part of that, but his imagination was part of it. And I think a lot of what Fred did as an adult was in a way trying to mend or speak to what his own child would have, his inner child would have wanted to have heard about all those things, you know.
This idea that comes up also in the film, going back to the fact that he was chubby as a kid. And I think Jean-Louis Lee says this in the film, talks about how the kind of will Fred Rogers had as an adult, his self-discipline, and his connection to the numbers 1, 4, 3. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So it's one of those things that I didn't know going into it, but he had incredible, incredible discipline. You know, he was a vegetarian for most of his life. He would get up every day at 5 a.m. He would read the Bible, either in English, French, Hebrew, or Greek. He spoke all those languages. And he would then go to the local Pittsburgh Athletic Club and swim for an hour. And the story we heard, which is incredible, is somebody one day, a journalist, went with him when Fred was in his 60s. And they go and they swim together at the athletic club, and they get out of the pool, and Fred goes over to the scale after he's done swimming and weighs himself, and the scale goes to 1, 4, 3. And he smiles, and he says, "Well, why are you smiling?" And he said, "Well, I've weighed 143 pounds every day of my life since the early 1960s. This is 40 years later, which is incredible. And he said, "Well, why 1, 4, 3? And he said, "Well, 1, 4, 3 is a magical number. 1 stands for I, 4 stands for love, and 3 stands for you. And that's what that means. So every time I step on the scale, it's a bit of self-affirmation." And that's how Fred thought. And when you go back through the shows, oddly, 1, 4, 3 is tucked away in the margins of many episodes of the show. It really was like a number that meant a great deal to him.
That's Morgan Neville, recorded live in Park City last week. He directed the film Won't You Be My Neighbor, which premiered on Friday as part of the Sundance Film Festival. There's still 2 chances to see the film, Friday afternoon at 12:30 at the Ray Theater in Park City, or Saturday evening at 6 at the Salt Lake City Public Library. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the filmmaker Morgan Neville. We're talking about his film, which is premiering at the Sundance Film Festival, about Mr. Rogers. It's called Won't You Be My Neighbor? You've described the show, Fred Rogers' show, as a parable machine. Mm-hmm. And we had talked earlier about his willingness to confront difficult issues. But talk about the first week of that show, how they take on the Vietnam War. Yeah.
I mean, if anything, I think we dialed back just how much of the show was speaking to what's going on. I mean, his show was a thinly veiled comment on what was happening in society, and whether you're talking about, bullying, or talking about nuclear holocaust, or talking about assassination, or talking about Vietnam. And he did all those things, talk about AIDS. All of it is in the show, incredibly. But in the first week show, this is February 1968, the first week show is about, in the land of make-believe, for those of you who remember the land of make-believe, we go there, and King Friday decides that there are troublemakers and unruly people outside of the land of make-believe that might want to invade or cause trouble. So his solution is to build a wall around the land of make-believe to keep out all these people. I'm not kidding. This is the first week of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And finally, everybody in the neighborhood persuades King Friday that this is ill-informed and the people actually just want to be friends, and that the week ends with them tearing down the wall. And this is the kind of thing he did again and again and again. I mean, the model was you had a kind of King Friday was a kind of clueless, imperious leader, and everybody else around him had to convince him that he was completely wrong-headed about everything. But he listened.
It seems like King Friday was another part of his identity, of his persona, another part of his... Yeah. It was the time that he felt maybe angry or impatient or wanted to be taken seriously.
Yeah, I think he became much more that way throughout the years.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is Fred... As I discussed earlier, that as the world changed, Fred realized he couldn't just do good work. I mean, part of it also is that Fred became a massively famous person and a hugely prominent public figure. So he's suddenly testifying. I mean, it starts to testify in Congress, but testifying everywhere and speaking at the White House and every education and, dozens of commencement addresses but on and on and on. Everybody wants him to weigh in on education. And he had very strong opinions about things like testing and things like different school standards and kindergarten and all these things. And I think really he just felt as the years went by that he had to stand up for himself to be taken seriously. And so he becomes much more of a kind of King Friday figure because it's what he needed to do to get his message across. And that transformation, it's interesting because on the surface of it, Fred Rogers, I can say it now because the film's done, but I didn't say this when I was pitching it, but Joanne Rogers said, Fred always said that he would make the worst subject ever for a book or a documentary because he was so boring. I disagree. But I think part of what she was saying is he had this routine. The show, if you take the first episode of the show and the last episode of the show and kind of play them on a loop, it's almost like, time keeps going forever. And he thought of it that way. He wanted, his first priority was to have enough episodes for a child to get through their entire childhood without seeing a repeat. But then he wanted to keep it going in this way. But every episode began the same way, the song, the sweater, the sneakers. And there were all kinds of reasons for that. But I think there was a consistency to him throughout that as a filmmaker and the question of kind of the character and what happens to him, that you have to then take that and really put it under a microscope.
Yeah.
And so the changes that came out in big, big ways are there, but they're just subtle, and when you actually highlight them, you realize how huge they are. And that was really probably my biggest challenge making the film, was just kind of looking and seeing him under the microscope and realizing that he was changing. It was just the kind of thing you couldn't realize if you were watching him every day.
Yeah. Let's talk about his relationship with Francois Clemens. Mm-hmm. For those who don't remember, this was Officer Clemens, right? Mm-hmm. African-American. And this was an interesting moment, I have to say. First of all, there's this terrific scene. I feel like I remember it. I probably don't. Where Mr. Rogers is cooling himself in a kiddie pool, and he's got a hose, and he's drenching his feet to cool down. Mm-hmm. And this African-American policeman walks into the scene, and he invites him to sit down and cool his feet. Now, this is, what, the late 60s, early 70s?
Yeah, late 60s.
In the midst of a lot of racial tension going on. So there was a lot going on there. And his relationship with Officer Clemens, with Francois, the person, too, is really interesting. Would you just talk a little bit about that dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, Officer Clemens, Francois, was on the show for, you know, 20 years and would come back for guest visits. But early on, it is absolutely clear that Fred went out of his way to recruit Francois, who wasn't even an actor. He was an opera singer.
Yeah.
To come onto the show and become a police officer. And I think Francois's first reaction is, yeah, no black people want to be police officers. You know, that's the least trusted person in the neighborhood. I mean, it's literally what Francois told Fred. And Fred said, no, we're modeling something here. I mean, everything he did was so full of intention. And this is early 68, he puts Francois on the show, and he stays there for decades. But as a model of, like, the police officer in the neighborhood is a black man. Later, when they have a mayor in the neighborhood, it's a black woman. But what he's showing there, and it has so many different layers to it, of them bathing their feet together in the same swimming tub at the same time that, you know, there was so much racial segregation still to that point. And they have this incredible kind of duet together, and, you know, they express their mutual admiration and love for each other. And then when Francois takes his feet out, Fred dries his feet with his towel. You know, a whole nother layer of message there. And, you know, there was nothing accidental about this at all. You know, and that's the kind of thing that's kind of radical about him, when you realize that, you know, what he was doing was, again, it's just the Christian thing to be doing.
Yeah.
But that wasn't always, you know, the thing that most people thought was the socially acceptable thing to be doing.
Francois Clemens is gay. Fred Rogers didn't know that at the time. Francois was married to a woman for a time before he came out. And this is one of these complicating aspects of Fred Rogers' life. He had a trouble with that. And this seemed like, for a time anyway, a blind spot initially. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's one of these things, if you talk about, you know, not trying to kind of deify Fred, I think it's one of these moments where he made a very difficult decision that you could look at and say it was a bad decision to make, which is, you know, he basically insisted that Francois stay in the closet and that he couldn't go to the gay bars in Pittsburgh and he couldn't be out in any way whatsoever. And though he knew Francois was gay and empathize with him on a human level, but at the same time, Fred's argument was, you know, we have sponsors on the show. Children's television is probably, you know, when you come to any those kinds of issues, particularly in 1970, would be a very difficult place to have an openly gay character on a children's television show. And Francois was hurt by it, and over the years came to forgive Fred for it. And I think Fred similarly went on his own journey where he felt like he would have made a very different decision a decade later, you know, even in the early 80s. You know, but he was very close with the gay community. Many of their friends, many of the people on the show, you know, were homosexuals. And it was just, I don't think it was a personal thing. I think it was literally Fred trying to navigate these worlds, but it's one of those times where you can't always do the right thing in all cases.
His son says in the film, I sometimes wonder myself what it was like to almost have the second Christ as my dad. Was it hard for his kids? to have Mr. Rogers as your dad?
Yeah, I think it would be. And I think, you know, and having talked to both of them, his two sons, he had two sons, talking to them both at length about it, I think that Fred was great at talking to kids when they were 2 or 4 or 6 or 8 or even 10. He was not so great at talking to 17-year-olds and 20-year-olds in the middle of the 1970s when his kids came of age.
Yeah.
And I think it was really tough in a lot of ways. And it's not that he was unsympathetic to them, but I think literally his frame of references were so off from what was happening in youth culture at that time that he just, there was no way for them to find common ground. And I think they both had a tough journey figuring out who they were, but never without love for their dad, but it was just without understanding. And again, it's showing that Fred was not perfect in every way.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that was something that he really worked hard to try and rectify, but something I know he felt a lot of grief about.
This I'm not sure what time period is necessarily, but there came a time, and we see some talk shows on Fox News starting to question the ideas of Fred Rogers, that he destroyed a generation because he told everyone they were special and that not everyone is special. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like this backlash again. What do you make of that? Because this is another thing you explore in the film.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it was like a couple of op-eds started, and then it became a thing, and it's kind of a counter-narrative to Fred Rogers that I think emerged,
yeah.
Which is, in a way, a kind of... it's similar to the narrative we hear about millennials, you know, that there was a generation of kids that felt entitled and were told they were special, and let's blame Fred Rogers for that. And I think... And that all started when Fred was very much alive, and that hurt him deeply. And I think, and he even addresses it in the film, and he started addressing it in his last address he ever gave, public address, at Dartmouth College. That to him, it completely misses the point of what he's saying. He's not saying you can do no wrong and everything you can do is special. He's saying everybody is worthy of love and of being loved and of loving themselves. And that if we're made by our Creator, there's something special in each of us. To him, it was essentially a Christian understanding of what specialness meant. And that's something that he, for children who maybe felt worthless, who he had this communication with, this relationship with, letting them know that they had some worth in this world, that they weren't worthless. I think that's what it's about. It's not saying you don't ever have to do anything to prove yourself. It's just saying that that I'm here and I'll love you unconditionally.
In his final days, as he was dying, he has a phone call with Yo-Yo Ma. Mm. And it seems like just a lovely moment. Can you say something about that? It's in the film.
Yeah, as I said, they'd remained very close friends. And Yo-Yo, Fred loved classical music. And Fred asked Yo-Yo to play something for him. So with Fred, with the phone up to Fred's ear, Yo-Yo put the phone down and played a number of the Bach cello suites for Fred. This is just maybe a week before he passed away, and Yo-Yo told us the story and played for us. But it's this. To me, it's just beautiful and heartbreaking and everything at the same time. I mean, Fred died relatively suddenly. I mean, his illness was about 2 months, and he died of stomach cancer, which I think had been going on for a very long time, but he had ignored it. And, you know, people theorize about for somebody who spent all of their time kind of listening to other people's grievances and kind of bottling it up, was there some at some level, was stomach cancer Fred's kind of keeping everybody else's problems inside of himself? And I don't know what to think about that. But Fred, ultimately, the conversation he had the day before he died with Joanne, to me, was the most revealing of all, where he said to her, am I a sheep or am I a goat? And it's from the Gospel of Matthew. And it means essentially, am I one of God's flock or am I a goat? Am I one who's unworthy and not going to go to heaven? And the fact that Fred Rogers was thinking this on his deathbed, I mean, it's somebody who, if anybody was a sheep, and this is essentially what Joanne said to him. She said, if ever there was a sheep, you're one of them. You know, and that is Fred, though. He was not a saint. He was a seeker and questioning everything, always, from the moment, you know, he was a child to the moment he died. And that's what makes him so human. And that one, for me as a filmmaker, makes him such a compelling character to delve into.
It's Morgan Neville. He directs the new documentary film, Won't You Be My Neighbor, part of the Sundance Film Festival. Morgan Neville, congratulations. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Mari Reiser of the Utah Olympic Park, to Chris Pulley of Wasatch AV. Thanks also to Amy Agostino, Dan Kogan, and Geraldine Dreyfus, of course, of Impact Partners, and Karen Capatosto, producer of Won't You Be My Neighbor. Thanks also to Michaela Ball and KUER's engineer, Lewis Downey. The show was directed by Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.